I'm Jess Harold, and I'm here at the Supreme Court meeting with Lord Newburger of Abbotsbury, who is retiring this summer as President of the Supreme Court. Having studied chemistry at Oxford, Lord Newburger eventually went on to have a distinguished legal career, specialising in landlord and tenant law. Quickly rising through the profession, he was called to the bar in 1974, made a QC in 1987, and became a High Court judge in 1996. He ascended to the House of Lords in 2007, became Master of the Rolls in 2009, before becoming President of the Supreme Court in 2012. Lord Newburger, by anyone's standards, that is a highly impressive career. What do you think that young man studying chemistry would have said if you told him he would one day be in charge of the highest court in the land?
I think he'd have suggested that you seek psychiatric treatment. I think he would have been astounded. He'd never considered a career in the law. Knew very little about law, and certainly had no thoughts of going into law, which is, in retrospect, very strange, because I think that such talents as I had and have should have led somebody to think that maybe you should be a lawyer. I think I was very much influenced by my mother, who didn't approve of lawyers, who said that lawyers were just acted for whoever paid them, which was, of course, absolutely true. It's the way the system worked. And I think I'd sort of mentally written it off. Although, curiously, I was an argumentative child, and she trained me to be a lawyer without realizing it by getting bored when I kept on challenging things she asked or said or ordered, and would say, "Now we've argued enough about this, we'll change sides." You must argue my view. And I think that was quite good training, although it wasn't intended to be.
Well, thankfully you did find your way to the law eventually, but I see your periodic table on the wall. Presumably you're still very interested in science and follow scientific advancements?
I'm still interested in science and try and follow scientific advances and research. Not just in chemistry. I can't pretend to great expertise, but I was quite lucky in that my science suddenly specifically came into my work after I'd become a High Court judge. They needed more judges to do patent cases. And I was fingered because I had a chemistry degree. And patent law and the subject matter of patents are both very interesting. And that helped stimulate my interest in science, which is still present.
Do you think there's the kind of methodical thinking that is involved in science is helpful, both as a lawyer and as a judge? Or?
Very much so. I annoyed and amused some German lawyers once when I went to speak at the Max Planck Institute in Hamburg, a very impressive institution, I might say. Where they were a bit bemused at the idea of somebody who'd only done 1.5 years legal study being president of the Supreme Court. And in Germany, of course, they take preparation and law studying very seriously for lawyers and for judges, and you might do 7 years. And they said, how could somebody who'd done 4 years chemistry and 1.5 years law become a barrister and then a serious judge? And I said that I'd noticed in science that it was quite easy for mathematicians to move to physics, physicists to move to chemistry, and chemists to move to biology, but much more difficult to move the other way. And that's because it was easier to move from a very rigorous subject to a less rigorous subject. And I said, therefore, to move from science to law wasn't that difficult.
And how well did that go down?
I think a mixture of annoyed and amused. It's a gross oversimplification. There's a difference. Lots of differences and lots of similarities between scientific and legal thinking. But I think my training as a scientist did help introduce a degree of discipline, which maybe I wouldn't have had if I hadn't done science.
Now, in practice, you had a specialism as a property lawyer, and you yourself said in your valedictory ceremony that landlord and tenant law still has a rather special place in your heart.
Yes, it does. No, sorry.
But what is it that makes it such a special area of practice?
I suspect most people feel that the area they specialised in, if they enjoyed it particularly, has something special about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it had a number of features. First, it was a wonderful mixture of statutory interpretation, common law, ancient land law, fact, expert evidence, and in terms of the actual practical work, it was a wonderful mixture of court work, conference work, and written work. Secondly, although I didn't realise it at the time, in fact I was rather jealous of my friends in grander chambers who earned bigger fees, spent all their time in the Royal Courts of Justice, whereas I was trolling round the county courts in and around London and sometimes even further afield. But I did an enormous proportion of court work on my own without being led right from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And often in not very well prepared cases in front of judges who maybe didn't know this area of law very well and were in a hurry because the pressures of work in the county courts was considerable. And it really taught me to think on my feet and to learn how to cross-examine without any prior warning, to learn to make submissions on law at very short notice. And it was really good training and quite challenging and good fun.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any standout memories from your time at the property bar?
Probably, if I go through my memory, an awful lot. I think my first outing in the Court of Appeal was in front of a judge who I appeared in front of quite a lot, Lord Justice McGaw, who was a very large, red-faced Irishman, Ulsterman, who'd played rugby for Northern Ireland, and was very choleric, very easily angered. And the first time I appeared in front of him, I remember going back to chambers in the afternoon of the, I think we came, we started after lunch and we had half a day, and I went back to chambers wondering if I was actually going to have the guts to turn up next morning in front of him, and saying to my colleagues I really didn't think I was a strong enough character to make it at the bar. He was a very tough and aggressive judge, but again, standing up to him and learning just to do one's best and not give up was very good training. That was one. Others were in front of quirky county court judges,
mm-hmm.
who said and did things which now would have them dismissed. Racist and homophobic comments, sometimes to the barristers in court and more often out of court about cases. Not very often, but at the time I was vaguely shocked, and sometimes you thought they were characters. Now it would have been completely unacceptable. There were some outstandingly good county court judges too, but there were some who were pretty pretty prejudiced. I suppose I remember my first outing in the House of Lords, in front of the Law Lords, pretty well. Not least because I was against a QC, I was still a junior barrister. And my opponent got a really bad time, and I was treated with great respect and encouraged, and it was clear that I'd won. And my opponent, it was Gavin Lightman, who later became a High Court judge, my opponent said to me, well, I've never been treated like this by the House of Lords before, you must buy me lunch. You've obviously won. So I bought him lunch. 6 weeks later we got the result, he won 5-0.
Has that influenced how you approach life as a judge at all, do you think?
I'm conscious that sometimes I'm appearing to make the parties think that I'm with one side,
mm-hmm.
whereas in fact I'm with the other. I think sometimes, particularly if you're inclined to give a judgment that would be quite brave or quite innovative, you really put the party who's making the brave argument through the hoops, testing the argument with them in court. And by testing an argument, you often give the impression, normally unintentionally, that you're actually against them. But actually what you're trying to do is to make sure their argument really hangs together. And it's quite difficult to know what to do, but occasionally say, because a judge who says, I haven't made up my mind, but, is slightly giving the game away.
Yeah.
But one has to be careful of not making the party who may lose think that you're with them, because they may then not put their case as well and strongly and forcefully as they would.
And they might have to buy lunch.
Yes, that's less of a concern. They can always get their money back, but they can't change the decision.
And how do you think that the specialism, property law, and maybe particularly landlord and tenant law, the practice has evolved from your time to what we see today?
It's quite difficult for me to answer that with any confidence, because we have a few, but not very many, landlord and tenant cases here. And I can look at the law reports and see, and the Estates Gazette law reports, and have a look, see what's going on. I think that what was remarkable about my time was, first, when I started, and indeed almost throughout my career, the enormous amount of court work, and small court work, which was small in the sense of in the county courts and didn't necessarily last very long, but was actually quite significant cases in terms of law and fact, and went to the Court of Appeal. And then, around the time I became a middle-ranking junior, almost to the time that I actually left to become a judge, there was a very large amount of rent review work. And I think that one thing that did happen in the landlord and tenant field was that, from being a bit of a backwater that everybody thought they could do, where lots of barristers thought they could practice successfully, a bit, where all the cases were in the county court and went to, and those that went into the Royal Courts of Justice went there because they were appeals from the county court, it became a bigger money, bigger, more impressive subject, a lot more high court work. And with rent review, a lot of big money work. And also, for some reason, there were a number of, not landlord and tenant so much, but landlord cases as well, which went to the High Court. And I think one of the things that's changed is, I think, although this is impression from discussing things, is the reduction in court work. And I think that may be a general comment in small claims, in smaller work, simply because the cost of litigation has gone up relative to the what's at stake. But it's a bit unsafe for me to compare the position now, because I am out of touch with the day-to-day first instance work.
Is the cost of litigation, is that something that is of concern?
It's concern to anybody who's interested in the rule of law and access to justice. I think attempts by all sorts of people, including myself, to cut down the cost and time of litigation have not been terribly successful. And a lot of things which were intended to cut down the cost actually comply with the law of unintended consequences and do just the opposite. So I think sorry, I keep on coughing. It's very annoying. I hope it doesn't matter. I think that the problem is that, a fundamental problem is that we want the best people to become lawyers, and the best people want to be paid well, coupled with the fact that London is probably the legal centre of the world, which brings in a lot of money and means that lawyers, again, the lawyers are able to charge a lot. And that filters down through the system. That's the first problem. Our lawyers cost a lot, and they're very good, mostly. Secondly, our litigation system involving things like disclosure and cross-examination and oral submissions is inevitably expensive compared with a system that doesn't have automatic disclosure in every case, that doesn't have cross-examination in almost every case, and doesn't have oral submissions in almost every case. And I think when it comes to smaller cases, we have to be pretty brutal and be prepared to accept that it's better to have cheap and dirty justice rather than no justice. If you have a claim for £10,000, you are not getting access to justice if it costs £150,000 to recover it. So you're faced with two options. One is to provide legal aid for £150,000 worth of fighting to recover £10,000 of money. That's not justified.
Not sustainable.
The second is to say, hard luck, you can't go to court. Well, that is not access to justice, and that's not acceptable. And the third is to say, well, we will provide a system, a mechanism, whereby your claim can be determined for, say, £5,000 on each side, which is still, one might think, disproportionate, because you're still spending as much, but with both sides, as is at stake. But inevitably, it will be a more superficial investigation, but at least you've got an investigation, and I think that's what we should be looking at.
So in the light of those concerns about sort of the rising costs of litigation, what is your view of how well mediation and ADR has performed in the property context?
Again, I would be entirely relying on what people tell me. The obvious advantage, the advantages and disadvantages of ADR and mediation are obvious. If they work, then they have saved everybody a lot of money, a lot of anxiety, and a lot of time. And therefore, it's great. But if they don't work, then they've added to the delay and they've added to the cost, and you've still got to go to court. So I think one has to look quite coolly and carefully at how often mediation succeeds and try and work out, if one can, and I suspect one can't, what sort of cases and at what stage cases should mediate. And I'm not sure how much work has been done on that. But in general, it's fair to say that the risk of not a mediation not working and therefore increasing costs and delay seem to be sufficiently low to justify a view that mediation and ADR should be generally encouraged. And that's a rather roundabout way of saying that my impression is that a relatively high proportion of cases that mediate do mediate successfully. But that is impression, I must emphasize. And therefore it's to be encouraged. But that is impression.
And I suppose there must be certain types of dispute in the landlord and tenant arena, say, for example, forfeiture, where compromise is difficult to achieve, where the two parties are obviously at very different
standpoints. I mean, very often it seems to me that the, unless the tenant has an argument on waiver or something like that, the tenant is probably often unrealistic in trying to fight off the forfeiture. And very often the landlord is unrealistic in trying to fight off the tenant getting relief from forfeiture. But there will be cases where a tenant is quite right to be fighting the forfeiture and the landlord's quite right to be fighting the relief. But any case, the other advantage of mediation is that in some cases you can get a settlement that pleases both parties that you could never get if you went to court, because the parties are free to agree whatever they want, whereas a judge's power is very limited. For instance, on a relief and forfeiture case, he either grants it or he doesn't. Although it's fair to say it, a judge could grant it on terms, and therefore the terms introduce an element of flexibility. But nonetheless, there's obviously much greater flexibility in many cases when it comes to mediation.
And had you been practising today, you would now have been operating in the new business and property court.
Yes.
Do you think that will provide any real changes of substance in sort of how litigation is handled and the cost and so forth?
It's hard to answer that, not again, because I'm not as close to first instance work as I was. It seems to me that it's partly a relaunch of what already exists, and none the worse for that. And partly it's trying to ensure that the UK, and in particular London's reputation and ability in commercial and property disputes, is honed so that it is even better and stronger than it already was and is. And therefore I think it's very good, A, presentationally, and B, in terms of substance.
Mm-hmm. But do you think there are even sort of greater steps that should be taken to evolve our courts to meet the needs of modern society?
There are always things that can be done to improve the present position, and I don't think we should be shy of looking what's done in other courts and learning from it. I think we have tended to be behind in terms of some courts in terms of IT, but the Treasury has made money available for improving the IT generally in courts, and that's to be welcomed. For me to say exactly how the Business and Property Court could be improved would be inappropriate, because as I say, I don't have all the details at my fingertips, but it's quite clear that those in charge of modernisation, judges, court service officials and others, and indeed practising lawyers, are doing everything they can to make the Business and Property Court the leading world court in the area of commercial and property litigation. And it's certainly the biggest, and certainly the leading court in terms of size and volume of work, and long may continue.
You also served as president of the Property Litigation Association for a number of years. And how well do you think that organisation has helped to shape property litigation?
I think it's done remarkably well, and I don't say that as somebody who had much involvement in what they did, so it's not taking pride in anything I've done. I was very pleased indeed to be asked to be president and to serve for as long as I did. I think it's made an enormous difference. I think it's helped to raise standards among property litigators. I think it's helped to ensure a degree of mutual trust among people who often act against each other. And I think there is sometimes a confusion of thought in the litigation world. Just because you're against somebody doesn't mean you have to be unpleasant to them, doesn't mean you shouldn't cooperate with them. All it means is that you can't go beyond what is in the interests of your... You can't do anything that isn't in the interests of your client. But actually, to negotiate in a friendly way with your opponent, your opposing lawyer, is less effort, takes less time, leads to less room for misunderstanding, and therefore it's the benefit of your client, and makes life more civilised. I think also they've had a number of... they've done a lot in education, a lot in terms of educating members, and however senior you are, you can always do with being educated, but it's particularly valuable for more junior, inexperienced members.
Yep.
I think they've done a lot in terms of deciding what changes would be in the public interest in terms of property litigation, and have pressed the relevant bodies for changes, and have achieved some of those changes. And I think, therefore, what they've done is in the public interest, because it's improved the standards of property litigation lawyers, it improved their working practices, and it's improved aspects of property law practice, which has been, again, to the benefit of the country. So I think it's a splendid organisation.
Now let's turn to the Supreme Court itself. And Lady Hale said during your valedictory that you had had initial doubts about the creation of the Supreme Court. Is it safe to say that those doubts have now given way?
I feel slightly defensive about this. When Joshua Rosenberg did a programme on the radio about the Supreme Court, which was not yet in existence.
Mm-hmm.
He interviewed a number of law lords to ask them what they thought about the fact that their appeal committee was going to be changed into a separate court. And with one exception, all the law lords who were interviewed said how wonderful it was going to be and said all the pluses. I was the only one who said there were these advantages, but there were these potential disadvantages. And inevitably, because I was the only one who was prepared to not toe the party line, suggest there were downsides as well as upsides, the coverage of what I said was purely my negative comments. So having got that defensive point out of the way, I think my two primary concerns were that taking the law lords out of the House of Lords and creating a new Supreme Court might involve the Supreme Court getting, as it were, ideas above its station and pushing the boundaries of the between the role of the executive, the legislature, and the on the one hand, and the judiciary on the other, and that could lead to friction, which would be both unnecessary and potentially dangerous. And my second concern was that the court service and the court system of England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland were underfunded, and to spend a lot of money on moving the law lords into the Supreme Court concerned me, because the money could in many ways be better spent on the courts lower down the system. My first concern, I think, has not eventuated. It seems to me that although the power of the judiciary has expanded, it's expanded primarily due to the advent of the Human Rights Act. And that was Parliament's choice to give the judges, give individuals the rights, and give judges, inevitably, the power to adjudicate on those rights. I think there have been other factors too, but that's probably the principal factor. The second concern is still a concern, in the sense that this court is, as it should be for the UK Supreme Court, very well fitted out, very well run, very well maintained. It'd be quite wrong if it wasn't. But it does mean that that comes out in practice of the budget of the courts. And I still feel, when I'm visited by even judges from the Royal Courts of Justice, but more so from judges from many of the county courts and Crown Courts, that they must think that we are living in a lap of luxury compared with many of their courts, which are very run down, and literally sometimes when it rains there have to be buckets in the court to deal with the leaks. So my second concern, I think, was justified.
Mm-hmm.
My first concern, I don't think, was unjustified, but it's turned out not to be a problem.
Now, as for your time as president, is it fair to say that one of the things you sought to achieve was to reduce the length of Supreme Court judgments?
Yes. I can't say it was one of my stated aims, but I became aware that there was a perception, which I thought was justified, that our judgments were too long. And I must put my hands up as being somebody who tends to write long rather than short judgments. I remember being quite cross when I was a law lord, as some researcher had done a research to suggest, I think if I remember rightly, my judgments were longer than anybody else's. And I was quite cross, because when I looked at what this researcher had done was to count the number of paragraphs in each judgment, which struck me as very odd, because one of my colleagues at the time, Lord Scott, often produced judgments which contained paragraphs which ran over more than one page, whereas I tend to produce judgments with paragraphs which are very short. Indeed, my colleague Lord Sumption has referred to such judgments as reading more like shopping lists. And it seems to me that particularly now we've got word processors with word count, it's rather extraordinary not to count the number of words rather than the number of paragraphs. But that's, by the way, in general, our judgments are a bit long. Some of my colleagues write shorter judgments than others. Lord Hodge writes particularly concise, clear judgments. The problem is, what is the Supreme Court for? Is it simply to decide points as clearly and shortly as possible? Or is it to explore the law a bit more to help people? Some judges believe in expressing their doubts and accepting the contrary view to the one they formed has some force. Other judges think their role is simply to say, this is my conclusion for the following reasons. My tendency is to do the first, but I can see that there's quite a lot to be said for the second.
And speaking as someone who spends a reasonable amount of time reading reporting on property law judgments in the Supreme Court, it does seem that the number of decisions in which there are multiple speeches has been drastically reduced.
That I am quite keen on, and always have been. It's quite difficult, but the problem is that, put dissenting judgments on one side, obviously if you disagree, you write a dissent. I think dissenting judgments often can be short, but sometimes you feel you have to explain in some detail why you disagree. Concurring judgments are more of a problem. If you concur because you don't agree with the reasons in the first judgment, but you have entirely different reasons, then you've got to write, of course. If you really agree with the reasoning in the first judgment, but want to put it in your own words, then, although I must admit I've done it quite often myself, it must be questionable whether there's any real value in it. Because although you think you're saying the same thing as your colleague, when you're inevitably using different words, if it was identically worded, then there's no point. And once you use different words, then particularly when different facts arise, what you may be saying may inadvertently produce a different result, or arguably a different result, from what your colleague has said. And therefore, I think one has to be very careful about concurring judgments. Also, time is money, and the more judgments there are in a case, and the longer the judgment in the case, as you referred to earlier, the more risk there is that people have to spend an awful lot of time reading it. I said before that it is very unfortunate if, when reading a judgment, you lose the will to live. It's even more unfortunate when you realise it's one of your judgments you're reading. But I think there are areas where it is essential only to have one judgment. For instance, in the Pinnock case, where we were saying how in the county court, district judges and circuit judges should approach Article 8 claims in possession actions. That was a practical issue, although there was a legal, substantive legal issue as well, but it was a practical issue. And to have more than one judgment in the same case saying how they should approach matters would be very unsatisfactory. On the other hand, a topic which has been dealt with a lot by academics, but until recently hadn't been dealt with much in any judgment of the top court, was that of unjust enrichment. In relation to that, it seemed to me that when we produced our first couple of decisions in the past 2 or 3 years, it was quite useful to have more than one judgment, because we were taking the law forward in a way that we were entering uncharted territory, and to have slightly differently expressed views, we could see how they worked in the courts below, we could see what the academics said about it, and then that could feed back into our future decisions and we could take the law forward. So there are times when concurring judgments actually are useful. But the disadvantage of cutting down on concurring judgments is that you are discouraging your colleagues from doing the thing which most judges like doing most, which is writing judgments. And it's difficult, therefore, to push it too far here. One thing I have done to try and encourage people not to have more than one judgment in some cases is to suggest that two judges get together, two of my colleagues get together and write a joint judgment. Sometimes that can be done in a case where there are two issues and they can each deal with one of the issues. Sometimes they collaborate and produce what's more of a genuine joint judgment.
Yeah, Lady Hale said you kind of encouraged a collegiate atmosphere between the justices.
Yes. I mean, early on in our, when I was in the House of Lords, it was very rare for that to happen. And Lady Hale and I did it on at least one occasion. And it's a good thing to do.
Now, you of course delivered the lead judgments in a number of property cases over the years during your time in the Supreme Court. And I was actually at your Blundell lecture a couple of years ago. I don't know if you remember, we took your photograph then as well. And you spoke with some pride about the increase in the number of property cases heard by the court. I assume that's something you're still...
Yes, I think it's slightly tailed off this year, I think. But yes, I think it's one of the fact features of this court that you probably could detect an increase in certain types of case being heard by reference to the past expertise of the justices of the court. I don't think it's an enormous factor, but I think it's a slight factor. It's inevitable that it is. But it's a good reason for having a good spread of different expertise.
Are there any areas of property law that you would have liked to provide clarification on, but the opportunity never arose?
Not, I can't think of anything in particular, no.
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 One theme over recent years in a number of property cases and cases from other fields is contractual interpretation.
Yes.
And we've had commentators who have spent many paragraphs, word counts, however you want to measure them, pages writing on the contrasted approaches that they perceive in cases like Arnold v. Britain, Rainy Sky, Wood v. Capita. Do you think, it might be difficult for you to say this still, well, whilst you're in situ until September, but do you think Arnold v. Britain was the swing back to literalism that many greeted it as, or was its effect less dramatic than that?
I think the trouble is that when it comes to contractual interpretation, you are concerned with what particular words mean in the context of a particular document executed in particular circumstances. And nobody doubts that you take into account what the words say. Nobody doubts that you take into account the document as a whole and its other terms. Nobody doubts that you take into account the surrounding circumstances when the document was executed. Nobody doubts that you take into account commercial common sense. How you weigh these issues, how you weigh these various factors up is very case sensitive. And inevitably there will be cases where different people come down different ways on the same set of facts and on agreeing all the factors which have to be taken into account. I think starting with investors' compensation, Lord Hoffman's famous judgment, we've been on a bit of a journey, which I hope has ended in Wood and Capita, where ultimately we've gone back to what Lord Wilberforce said in Prennan Simmons and in Reardon Smith and Hanson Tangham, in a couple of paragraphs in each case. And I think the trouble is that, as I think Lord Hodge said in Wood and Capita, I emphasise very strongly the importance of the words used in Arnold and Britain, because I thought you have to start with the words, and if they simply don't bear sensibly any other meaning other than those, the meaning which they appear to have when you look at them, you can't use surrounding circumstances and business common sense and the rest of the document to give them a meaning that they simply can't properly bear. Lord Carnworth, who dissented, felt that the words could properly bear a different meaning. And I would dearly have loved to agree with him, because it was a very unfortunate result. but I just felt the words were too clear. In Rainy Sky, Supreme Court didn't give the words their primary natural meaning, but gave the words a different meaning, which it felt the words could bear, because commercial circumstances justified it. I think the difficulty is that we have to explain our decision with some care, and when the Supreme Court's explaining its decision in a case that comes here to give guidance on interpretation, we have to set out our reasons in some detail.
Mm-hmm.
But whether it's terribly helpful to do so is a bit questionable. I hope Wood and Capita puts an end to it, but this week, I think, I can't remember if it's today or tomorrow, whether it's today or yesterday, we're giving a judgment. I wrote the judgment mm-hmm. in a case involving contractual construction. Mm-hmm. I've tried to keep out of any detailed analysis of the proper approach to construction, although if I remember rightly, I've referred to the construction of the contract having to be in accordance with the guidance given in Wood and Capita and the cases cited in Wood and Capita. But I think I've said enough, and many people probably think much more than enough, about contractual interpretation, the principles. It is quite difficult
yes.
to spell out in the yes. end. You have to do the best you can, balancing the various factors I've given.
It's, yes, not really a problem that's likely to go away yeah, anytime soon. Yeah.
I don't think it is, and I suspect the more guidance one gives, the more muddled everybody becomes, because you start looking at what the Supreme Court said about it and looking at the contract they were interpreting, rather than focusing, as you should do, on the contract that you are interpreting. And I think at times that from and including investors' compensation, it might have been better if nothing had been said in this court or the House of Lords.
Now, we wanted to take the opportunity to just ask you about a couple of talking points that are exercising our contributors at the moment. One thing that people frequently talk about is the 1954 Act. Do you think the time has finally come for reform?
I have, maybe a bit grand to call it a philosophical objection, but a philosophical objection it might be called, or possibly a principled objection, to the 1954 Act, and it's this. The 1954 Act is there, like the Rent Act used to be, like the Housing Act is now, like the agricultural legislation is there, for the purpose of protecting tenants. So, in my days, the Rent Act, now the Housing Act, more recently Housing Act, you can't contract out of it.
Mm-hmm.
If you grant a residential tenancy, the Housing Act, and before that the Rent Act, bite and apply, because tenants need protecting. Similarly, now, the oddity is that under the Landlord and Tenant Act, Part 2, meant to protect business tenants, but a landlord and tenant are free to agree that the Act doesn't apply. To me, that undermines the whole purpose of the Act.
Mm-hmm.
If tenants are free to say, I don't want the protection, then what's the point of protecting them? If you make it a matter of contractual freedom, which it is, then you could just as well say, junk the Act, and simply introduce, through the RICS or some other organisation, a system whereby the parties can have in a schedule to the lease all the provisions of the 1954 Act that give the right to a tenant to renew, and point with an arbitration provision rather than the court. So that's a fundamental objection to the 54 Act, to which I see no satisfactory answer. Having said that, as far as I know, in its 65 years of existence, the 1954 Act has been perfectly workable. Landlords and tenants have lived with it.
Mm.
And contrary to my principled argument. There is a practical argument that it works, the property market works perfectly well with it. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Against that, Scotland doesn't have its equivalent, and the Scottish property, commercial property market seems to work very well. So it's not for me to say whether it should be maintained or got rid of, but I think the principled argument to getting rid of the 54 Act is very strong, as I've shown, as I mentioned. On the other hand, the practical argument the other way is also fairly strong.
That might be particularly the case at the minute, because one other topic that it's very difficult for anyone to get away from is Brexit.
Yes.
What effect do you think that will come to have on property law?
I think I'm right in saying that EU law has not had a great, and had not had a very significant direct effect on property law. Obviously, there's a bit. And therefore, pulling out of the EU won't have much direct effect. Indirect, it's terribly difficult to predict, not least because we don't know what the terms on which we are going to leave the EU are going to be, let alone what our continuing terms of our continuing relationship with Europe is going to be. I suspect it's more a question of what effect it's going to have on the property market rather than on property law.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But I can't at the moment, although I can't pretend to have thought about it very deeply or much at all, I can't at the moment see much immediate or obvious consequence of Brexit on the law.
More likely to be in the sort of planning areas and things like that.
I think when it comes to public law, it may have a greater effect but even there, on the law itself, I'm not sure. But as I say, until we know the terms on which we leave and the terms of our continued relationship, it's quite difficult to predict. Indeed, very difficult.
Now, during your valedictory speech, you spoke very passionately about the importance of the judiciary and the role they play in the rule of law. And I imagine things like that were very foremost in your mind when the Brexit case, to use the vernacular, was heard and the coverage that resulted. Was it important for you to try and make clear to sort of the everyday person on the street the true nature and importance of the role of the judge?
Yes, I mean, I think, to me, although I can't pretend to be an expert on the current state of the curriculums in schools, but it's always been surprising how little education people receive at school as to the basis on which this country is organised and run constitutionally and practically. It's not just a question of understanding the role of the judges, it's understanding the separation of powers, elementary stuff really, that most people in the law and I suspect in politics take for granted. But even among MPs, talking to politicians occasionally, and indeed to journalists, the understanding of the role of the judiciary does seem to be very limited. There's a better understanding of the role of Parliament and ministers, although I sometimes wonder when I hear people talking about ministers being democratically elected, whether people actually understand the difference between the executive and the legislature. I mean, you know, virtually any minister is democratically elected, but only democratically elected as an MP.
Yeah, not into that position.
Not as a minister. And I think it's unfortunate because, particularly if you're from time to time going to seek support for housing benefit or something like that, having some understanding as to how the system works and who you should be approaching and why and how rights develop and so on, I would have thought would be essential. And yet people don't seem to get any sort of education about that. And at the risk of sounding preachy, I think they should. And if they do, then they would understand better the role of the judges. And because we are subject to exceptions such as the Miller case, but because we are low profile, and we should be low profile, people don't really understand what we do and why. And when we occasionally appear There is quite a misunderstanding as to, even among apparently well-educated journalists and others, as to what we do and why.
Perhaps the Supreme Court Guide for Bears should be required reading in schools. That might help.
I probably suggest that bears have a better idea of what we do than most human beings.
Talking about the importance of the judiciary, you've been a champion of diversity in the background of our judiciary, not just in terms of race and gender, but in terms of professional background as well.
Professional background and social economic background, which is a very difficult thing to deal with, because the die is largely cast by the time people get to the age where they're considering a legal career, let alone considering a judicial career.
And
yes, I am.
Do you think how much progress do you think has already been made, and how far still left to go?
In terms of gender, there's been real progress in terms of the senior judiciary, and even better progress in terms of the tribunal judiciary. But there is still a long way to go. But so long as we recruit, as I think we should and will, from the legal profession, there is a serious problem in that the proportion of women QCs is 13%, the proportion of women as partners in major law firms is about the same. And that's where we largely look to recruit High Court judges. So the fact that the High Court's got to 20% can be said to be something of an achievement. Now, of course, to call it an achievement when it should be 50% is sounds pretty pathetic. But there is a problem here. And a number of judges and others have done a lot to encourage really good women who might otherwise not apply to apply. We also have to try and look outside the legal profession, but it's quite difficult to know where else to look. The obvious area is among academics, and perhaps we're not as good as we should be at looking at employed lawyers and government and other places. So that's the problem. So far as ethnic minorities, BAME, are concerned, again, the tribunal judiciary does well. But the further up you go, the worse it gets. Mm. And it is pretty bad in the High Court, Court of Appeal, and here. In fact, hopeless here. It's the same sort of problem, but I think we're doing worse there than in relation to women in the senior judiciary. And when it comes to people from poorer backgrounds, that is quite a problem. Because, as I say, they often don't have the educational qualifications even to get into the legal profession in the first place. And it's very difficult for us as a judiciary to do much about it by the time they, in their 40s or when they're thinking of a judicial career, when people are thinking of a judicial career. But again, we should be going out there encouraging people to apply from that sort of background. Because the other thing is, as with women and ethnic minorities, people from poorer backgrounds are more modest, are less ambitious, are always looking, or more likely to be looking, at why they don't qualify. Whereas the standard public school white male will be much more self-confident and much more ready to apply. So that's the other reason we should be encouraging people, underrepresented groups, to apply.
Now, you're retiring this summer, and of course you'll be greatly missed on the bench, particularly by property lawyers, more than most, I would have thought. Do you believe that property law will be in safe hands with the remaining justices?
Yes, I do. I mean, one of the new, three new justices have been appointed, all, I think, excellent. One in particular, Lord Justice Briggs, soon to be Lord Briggs, I've known since we were at the bar, and although he didn't specialise particularly in property cases, he did a lot of property cases, and it will be in very, he will certainly be an expert in that field and be very good. I've sat with Lady Justice Black when we were in the Court of Appeal together, and doing a number of chancery type cases. Mm-hmm. And for somebody who didn't have a chancery background, I thought she showed remarkable ability.
And of course we should talk about your successor, Lady Hale. I'm sure you will agree she will lead with distinction.
Yes, I was a strong supporter of her appointment, and I'm delighted she's been appointed. She's got great humanity, a great intelligence, a good sense of humour, and it's terrific that we have the top judge in the UK as a woman in terms of coming
yes,
back to what we were
exactly.
talking about. But even ignoring the fact that she's, or putting on one side the fact that she's a woman, she will be a brilliant president, I'm sure. Yeah.
Is a good sense of humour a pretty vital part of the role?
Personally,
think?
I've found it invaluable. Mm-hmm. I think I have a good sense of humour, and I find it a very valuable quality to deal with setbacks, adversities and disappointments. If you can sort of laugh at yourself and laugh at what happens, not in a derogatory or unpleasant way, but if you can see the funny side.
Yeah.
When you've done something silly, which we all do from time to time, or said something you wish you hadn't said, if you can see the funny side, it softens the blow.
Definitely. If it wasn't for the mandatory retirement age, would you have liked to have carried on a bit longer?
I think I probably would, yes, to be honest. But I think there are advantages in going, although I seem very old to you, being able to go at 70 means that you have got the prospect, a better prospect of doing other things for a significant time than if you were going when you were significantly older. 5 years is a good period to have done this job for. And I think it's better to go when people say, why are you going, rather than when are you going? I am sorry to be going.
Yeah.
But I referred to my mother at the beginning of this discussion. I remember my mother telling me when I started going to teenage parties, it's very a good idea to leave while you're still enjoying yourself rather than waiting.
Yeah,
to
very wise.
So all in all, yeah, I would like to have done a bit more, but I think I think it's no bad thing that I'm going.
As a general point, do you think the mandatory limit comes at a cost to the profession?
I am on record as saying, and I strongly believe, that they should increase the retirement age to 75 for judges. Mm. There are a number of absurdities in the system. If people are fit to be jurors till they're 75, why aren't they fit to be judges? I am entitled, or not entitled, I'm permitted to come back and sit here as an additional judge, or indeed in the Court of Appeal, I think, as an additional judge, until I'm 75. If I'm fit to do that, why aren't I fit to sit here? And more broadly, the retirement age of has generally been going up, and judges used to be 75, and they've come down to 70. That being said, I think one would have to be quite cautious about increasing the retirement age for presently appointed judges. That might lead to bed blocking and changes in...
It would impede some of the diversification.
It would impede diversification, and it would also interfere with expectations that people might have had. So I can see I can see a particularly strong argument for increasing the retirement age of newly appointed judges to 75, particularly as there is such a difficulty, there is a real difficulty in finding sufficient people of the appropriate standard to become High Court judges because of the government's ill-advised interference with the judicial pension. Making it financially less attractive to become a judge. It's already financially unattractive for most successful barristers and solicitors to become judges, but this makes it even less attractive. And also the message it sends in terms of the value of the job in government eyes, that they make the overall pay significantly less because of the de facto cut in pension, means that the only likely way you're going to be able to encourage people to become more people to become judges is by saying to them, well, you know, we'll appoint you older when you've earned enough money, you don't really worry about the pay. But if you're appointing judges older, you're going to have to give them longer, a higher retirement age. Mm-hmm. So it's another argument. So I'm clearly of the view that they should increase the retirement age. But as I say, it's much more questionable whether it should be increased for serving judges. But I think they should increase it for newly appointed judges.
And lastly, one thing that many people will be very keen to know, you've possibly given a hint as to what the next few years might hold, but they're going to know what you're going to do next. As Lady Hale colourfully put it, action man Neuberger likes to keep busy and can't sit still for long. So surely retirement isn't retirement.
Well, I think my worry is, reflecting what Brenda said, that I won't have enough to do. My wife, Angela, is worried I'll have too much to do. I think at the moment I have three sort of components in what I'm thinking of doing. The first is something in the House of Lords. Mm-hmm. Because I became a law lord, I am a peer, I can go back to the House of Lords. And I hope and think I'd have something to contribute there, mm-hmm. but one will have to wait and see. The second thing is that, referring back to an early question, I was a scientist. I had the extraordinary compliment of being elected a fellow of the Royal, an honorary fellow of the Royal Society a couple of months ago, which in some ways has certainly, other than my judicial career, has been my proudest achievement. Mm-hmm. And I would very much like to contribute to the role of science in society, particularly in the law, and the removal of the silo mentality, so that scientists are not seen as a separate breed.
Another very misunderstood branch of society.
So much to offer the law and other aspects of society, and particularly post-Brexit, the importance of science in this country and the enormous contribution this country has made to science over the past 350 years is something that we have to maintain and develop. And, of course, I will learn an enormous amount of to do with science, which is very exciting. And the third component is that, like a lot of ex-senior judges, I will, currently intend to become an arbitrator and do some arbitration if I get appointments. Mm-hmm. So those are three strands of what I hope to do. I can see that my wife may turn out to be right. I may turn out to be very busy. Or I may turn out to be not have enough. We'll just have to wait and see.
If you do end up with a little bit more free time, what would be your ideal way to spend it?
I suppose holidays, mm-hmm. more reading for pleasure, more going to look at art, going to cinema, going to theatre, going to opera. Mm-hmm. I have no great hobby, I'm afraid. The great thing about the Royal Society and the House of Lords is that it may help me stop being too much of a one-trick pony, which I sometimes fear I am or have become.
Hardly. Well, thank you very much, Lord Neuberger, for sparing the time with us when a time when no doubt you were very busy. And whatever your future does hold, I hope your wife does manage to persuade you to take some time off at least. But very best of luck.
You're very kind. Thank you very much indeed.